Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Vijay Prashad, Professor of International Studies at Trinity College, who discusses the bloody conflict between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, with a focus on U.S. complicity in the rising death toll of Palestinian civilians. Dana Frank, Professor of History at the University of California, Santa Cruz, who explains the link between the flood of child refugees at the U.S. border and Washington's support for the corrupt post-coup government in Honduras. And Michelle Sutter of the group Money at Voters In, who talks about a referendum question that will ask California voters this November to support overturning the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Australia, one of the largest per capita carbon polluters on the planet, has repealed its carbon tax designed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Conservative Prime Minister Tony Abbott had campaigned for months to axe the tax, but only prevailed in a mid-July vote with the support of seven independent senators. The high-profile carbon tax sets a price on carbon emissions that recently rose to $25 Australian per ton in a law adopted by the previous Labor government in 2011. The repeal leaves Australia the second highest per capita carbon emitter in the world without a system to reduce carbon pollution. As an alternative, the Abbott government has proposed awarding grants to companies that voluntarily reduce carbon pollution, but the policy lacks any enforcement mechanism. The opposition Labor Party has vowed to campaign to restore a carbon emissions policy in Australia's next election in 2016. While conservative governments in Australia and Canada are pulling back from carbon targets, emissions trading is on the rise in the European Union, New Zealand, parts of the United States, and China is also now experimenting with carbon taxes in several regions. U.S. District Court Judge Cormac Carney ruled California's death penalty is unconstitutional for being arbitrary in a case involving a 1995 death sentence for murder in suburban Orange County, California. California has the nation's largest population of death row inmates, where over 40% of these 748 prisoners have been living on death row for over 19 years. Since a 2006 federal court ruling, there has been a de facto moratorium on the death penalty in the state. In 2008, then-California's Supreme Court Chief Justice Ronald George called the process of capital appeals deeply dysfunctional. Since California reinstituted the death penalty in 1978, the state has executed only 13 inmates, while 93 have died from old age, illness, or suicide. Judge Carney vacated the death sentence of Ernest Dwayne Jones, who was convicted of killing his girlfriend's mother in 1992. In his ruling, Judge Carney states, allowing the system to threaten Mr. Jones with the slightest possibility of death almost a generation after he was first sentenced violates the Eighth Amendment prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. In 2012, California voters narrowly upheld the state's death penalty law in a referendum, but the legislature has never allocated enough money to move capital cases to eventual executions. Meanwhile, a growing number of states across the U.S. have repealed the death penalty, including Maryland, Connecticut, New Jersey, and Illinois. Former U.S. Congressman Patrick Kennedy of Rhode Island took up the cause of improving the delivery of mental health care after he crashed his car near Capitol Hill in 2006, a consequence of his addiction to painkillers, including OxyContin. Kennedy, the son of the late U.S. Senator Ted Kennedy, did not seek re-election in 2010. In 2013, Kennedy formed Project SAM, Smart Approaches to Marijuana, in order to oppose a number of state initiatives to legalize marijuana. In February, Kennedy rallied the Just Say No crowd at the convention of the Community Anti-Drug Coalition of America. The coalition is campaigning to keep marijuana as a Class 1 drug, which categorizes it as having no medical use and among the most dangerous drugs in the U.S. Paradoxically, Kennedy and other anti-drug activists are allies with big pharma corporations like OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma, which is a major funder of the Community Anti-Drug Coalition. The Nation magazine reports that another anti-drug organization, the Partnership for Drug-Free Kids, is heavily funded by Purdue Pharma, as is Abbott Labs, maker of the opioid drug Vicodin. Opioid painkillers like OxyContin are linked to over 16,000 deaths annually in the U.S., and they are associated with overdose and addiction. The Federal Centers for Disease Control report more people die from legal painkillers than from illegal heroin and cocaine combined. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
After Israel's two-week military offensive targeting the Hamas government in Gaza, the death toll has risen to more than 600 mostly Palestinian civilians and more than 3,100 wounded, according to Gaza's emergency services. As of July 22nd, Israeli deaths totaled 29, 27 soldiers, and 2 civilians who died from injuries sustained from rockets fired from Gaza into Israel. According to news reports, Israel has attacked 2 Gaza hospitals since July 8th. At Gaza's Al-Aqsa Hospital, at least 4 people, including 2 patients, died and 60 were wounded on July 21st. Israel claims that their tanks targeted missiles hidden near the hospital compound, an accusation that Palestinian hospital officials have denied. The United Nations has emphasized that Palestinian civilians in densely populated Gaza have no place to hide from Israel's airstrikes, shelling, and ground operations, and children are paying the heaviest price. Jens Larkey, a spokesperson of the UN Office of Humanitarian Assistance, told a news briefing in Geneva that, quote, "There is literally no safe place for civilians. An estimated 500 homes have been destroyed by Israeli airstrikes in Gaza, and 100,000 people have sought shelter in UN-run schools, where food and water are now in short supply." After rockets fired from Gaza struck near Tel Aviv's airport, major airlines from the U.S. and Europe suspended flights to and from Israel's Ben-Gurion International Airport. Diplomatic efforts by Washington, Egypt, and Qatar have thus far failed to reach a ceasefire, owing to resistance by both Hamas and the Israeli government. Hamas, for its part, is demanding that any ceasefire include opening a major border crossing with Egypt, easing travel restrictions and the flow of goods, and the release of Hamas members who were jailed after the killing of 3 Jewish teenagers in the West Bank last month. Your reporter spoke with Vijay Prashad, George and Martha Kellner Chair in South Asian History and Professor of International Studies at Trinity College, who discusses the carnage in the Gaza conflict with a focus on U.S. complicity in the rising death toll of Palestinian civilians.
Well, you know, it's been a very harsh operation by the Israelis. It's lasted 2 weeks. 500-plus people have died, thousands of people injured, tens of thousands displaced. The United Nations has said that the level of this internal displacement in this particular episode has actually surpassed the displacement in all previous episodes, including Operation Cast Lead in 2009, which was the standard of how badly Israel could use its force in Gaza. So this now stands as the worst attack by Israel on Gaza. It's a very bad situation because, of course, you know, Gaza is occupied territory. It is under Israeli occupation. Despite the fact that Israel pulled out its troops in 2005, it never at any point surrendered its occupation of Gaza, which it has, you know, conducted since 1967, in which case, of course, that the legal ramifications of what Israel is doing, you know, has not been sufficiently, I think, explored, which is that, yes, it has been bombing Gaza mercilessly. On the other side, it has talked about things like ceasefires, but that is a duplicitous thing. You cannot have a ceasefire with a place that you are already in occupation of. There are no two parties here. There is the occupying party and then there's the occupied, in which case one has to see this as a situation where the occupier is bombing mercilessly the occupied and nobody around the world is willing to step in to tell the occupier that not only what they're doing is illegal, but it's also grotesque. I think that's really where we are. The narrative of this as a conflict with two parties fighting each other has dominated the discussion, and that is entirely to Israel's favor.
The Israeli government justifies their military operation and the high civilian death toll in Gaza on the premise that the governing body in Gaza, Hamas, is using civilians as human shields for their rockets and other military installations in the Gaza territory. Would you like to respond to that?
Yes. You know, Gaza has 2 million people in 140 square miles. It's an extremely dense zone. It's impossible, therefore, not to have civilian, you know, architecture next to places where guerrilla groups are going to fire rockets. When Israel says that Hamas is using Palestinians in Gaza as human shields, the question should be put back to the government of Israel. The cabinet of Mr. Netanyahu has to answer the question, are you not using settlers as human shields in your policy of extending the borders of Israel?
Professor Prashad, what responsibility does the United States have in this current conflict, given the fact that for many decades now the United States has provided Israel with over $3 billion, much of it in military aid, and is in large part underwriting this military operation in Gaza?
Well, there's the money. That's true. That's an important feature of U.S. support. But I think that's the lesser feature. The most important feature is the political backing. Over this last weekend, I was in New York at the UN building, and I was watching carefully the two meetings, especially the emergency session on Gaza, where the Jordanians were walking the halls with a resolution, a very good resolution, calling upon the belligerent power, but everybody, to enforce some kind of ceasefire. It was plain that there would be no affirming that resolution because the United States was against it. In other words, if tomorrow the Chinese or the Russians walk into the UN Security Council with a resolution that reads the following, we, pursuant of responsibility to protect, knowing destruction happening in Israel, call upon all member nations to conduct a no-fly zone over Gaza. It's a very simple resolution. It's exactly the kind of thing that the United States and France did for Libya, and of course destroyed Libya, but that's a separate question. But in this case, if they did that, they'd force the Americans to publicly veto it. And if they publicly veto it after 2 weeks of this merciless bombing campaign, let the United States look in the mirror and face itself as it continues to give a blank check to Israel to behave in this way. So in my opinion, the culpability of the United States is not just in the money it provides or the weapons. It's in the political cover, and that's infinitely worse than the money that's provided, because this political cover has, in a sense, made American diplomacy toxic. Everybody says that the United States cannot speak out of one side of its mouth in the Middle East, because whenever Israel comes in, it speaks from the other side. So I think it is really corrupting U.S. foreign policy. It's corrupting people like Mr. Kerry, who, when he is unguarded, speaks in one voice, and when the cameras are on, speaks in another. That is a definition of corruption. So I think the real culpability is in this 100% political backing, not just in the weapons or money.
That was Vijay Prashad, George and Martha Kellner Chair in South Asian History and Professor of International Studies at Trinity College. For more analysis and commentary on the current conflict between Israel and Palestine, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. While the humanitarian crisis on the U.S.-Mexican border has not abated, the number of unaccompanied children arriving from Central America to turn themselves into American Border Patrol agents has seen a decline in South Texas, from a high of some 2,000 minors crossing the border a week last month to fewer than 500 children this week. But the highly charged politics of the recent flood of refugees continues to take center stage in Congress and in the U.S. media. President Obama's emergency request for $3.7 billion to meet the crisis that would pay for an increase in the number of immigration judges, border patrol agents, and new detention facilities has run into stiff resistance in the Republican-controlled House. Meanwhile, GOP Texas governor and likely 2016 presidential candidate Rick Perry ordered up to 1,000 National Guard troops to his southern border in what many observers see as a transparent political stunt. The White House, in an effort to more directly deal with the source of the refugee crisis, has invited the presidents of Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras to meet with President Obama and Vice President Joe Biden on July 25th to discuss the surge of unaccompanied children fleeing these nations for the U.S. Your reporter spoke with Dana Frank, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz, who assesses the recent arrival of tens of thousands of children from Central America on the U.S. border, placing the current crisis in the context of the extreme violence in Honduras and the role the U.S. has played in supporting that nation's corrupt post-coup government.
We don't have the smoking gun on U.S. provoking the coup, but it's very clear that the U.S. allowed the coup to stabilize. This was in 2009, 5 years ago, June 28th. It recognized the post-coup dictator Micheletti as a legitimate equal to the deposed president. It recognized the elections that happened under the initial post-coup regime that were boycotted by almost all the Honduran opposition and almost all international observers, except the Republican Party of the United States refused to observe the elections. So the United States immediately recognized the outcome of that election even before the polls had closed and acted as if the subsequent administration, the post-coup regime of Porfirio Lobo, was a legitimate government. And that's when the U.S. had this fiction for years. In fact, the U.S. briefly suspended some, but not all military agents in Honduras during the immediate post-coup period. But in every year since that we have documented, and of course there's no transparency about much of the funds, but as much as we can tell, and certainly in the public record, the funds for the Honduran police and military have in fact increased every year since the coup, despite widespread documentation by the UN, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, you name it, of this vast criminality and corruption by the Honduran state security forces. So the U.S. has a direct responsibility here. They've been operating under this fiction that this government is somehow improving itself when it's clear that they're just feeding the beast. As the rectora of the university famously said, when the police killed her son, she asked for a cutoff of the age. She said, "Stop feeding the beast." Well, we've just actually fed a beast that's becoming a more and more dangerous monster. And so what's happening now is suddenly we're acting like there's just random violence and gangs down there when we have, in fact, helped create the situation. We've legitimated the government that is continuing to countenance and even encourage this situation and is, you know, just robbing the government coffers blind as we speak. I mean, there's lots of other things going on here that government is doing that are terrifying, including attacks against human rights defenders who try to document what's going on. So what's amazing is how entrenched, more and more entrenched, the State Department and the White House have been, despite tremendous congressional opposition. The congressional opposition up until maybe a month ago was getting stronger and stronger. And most recently, 108 members of Congress, which is a huge number for any kind of letter, wrote a letter to Secretary of State Kerry questioning U.S. support for the regime. Just over a year ago, 21 senators challenged Kerry on the human rights abuses by state-funded security forces, and that's very unusual with top leadership, and the State Department's just been blowing that off. I mean, what's really scary is now with this kids crisis, the Obama administration and the White House in particular has just asked for $18.5 million new money for the Honduran police to supposedly clean it up as a response to the flight of the children, and this is really scary. It's like the government of Honduras is being rewarded for chasing its children into a terrifying circumstances of migration across Guatemala and Mexico.
What could the United States do now to positively influence the dismal and dangerous current situation in Honduras from your perspective?
I mean, first of all, we can't add to even further militarization of our own border. We have to talk about how our policies have created this situation. It's not something that we're going to change overnight. So first of all, we have to stop celebrating the governments of Guatemala and Honduras as if they are our viable partners. We need to respect the work that the new government of El Salvador is going to be doing to try to address its own military and police and their corruption and the gang problem in El Salvador. But we also, I think, have to talk about the economic roots of that, which we haven't talked about, because there are policies of both the Honduran government and the United States government that are actively and at this moment creating more poverty, because these kids are not just fleeing violence, they're getting up in gangs because there are no jobs, and that's another reason for sending your kid out of there, because there's very tiny viable economy. So practices by the United States, such as through the International Monetary Fund and the Inter-American Development Bank and the World Bank, have actively supported privatizations and layoffs that destroy good government jobs there's a recent statement from the International Monetary Fund Executive Board saying, we're helping the Honduran government lower their wage bill. I mean, bawled about this. And also the Central American Free Trade Agreement is destroying the ability of small farmers and Honduran manufacturers to compete in the market because they have to compete with U.S. agribusiness and U.S. corporations, and that's destroying jobs in the manufacturing sector and the ag sector. So the U.S. has to stop acting like these kinds of economic policies are not destroying jobs.
How do you explain the Obama administration really continuing on these failed policies that are sure to backfire in the coming years?
Why is the U.S. doing this? Of course, we don't know. It's really this rear guard military reaction to democracy in Latin America. Is it about protecting U.S. economic interests? Honduras has always been the most captive nation in Latin America of the United States. Or are they playing for a long-term war with China, which is investing in Latin America, but not military at all? Or is it just that the military is an engine that runs of itself? I mean, but certainly for whatever reason of those, we need to be challenging it.
That was Dana Frank, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Find links to articles and resources analyzing the refugee border crisis on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. California voters will get a chance to weigh in on a referendum question with national consequences this November. The ballot question, Proposition 49, calls for overturning Supreme Court decisions Citizens United and McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission, which allowed almost unlimited and unaccountable money to flow into political campaigns. The California referendum effort is being spearheaded by the group Money Out, Voters In. The ballot question asks, shall the Congress of the United States propose and the California legislature ratify an amendment or amendments to the United States Constitution to overturn Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission and other applicable judicial precedents to allow the full regulation or limitation of campaign contributions and spending to ensure that all citizens, regardless of wealth, may express their views to one another and to make clear that the rights protected by the U.S. Constitution are the rights of natural persons only. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Michelle Sutter, who led the campaign through Money Out Voters In, or MOVI, and is now chairperson of the group Yes on Prop 49. Here she explains why her group pursued the ballot question option and how other states and municipalities are also working to overturn recent Supreme Court decisions on campaign finance law.
This is the issue we believe that Americans are most passionate about. But as John Nichols says, this is the most dynamic yet undercovered movement in America, and we think that's true.
The process of passing an amendment to the Constitution seems so laborious and really difficult. Do you think there's any other way to get money out of politics?
I don't think so. I mean, there was talk for a long while that this could be done through legislation. But I think folks have pretty much agreed that that's not workable. There are certain kinds of tweaks that one can do around the edges, but this Supreme Court will find that all of those laws, as they did, for example, when Montana tried to uphold their 100-year-old ban on corporate spending in elections, and the Supreme Court delivered a summary judgment that there can be no doubt that Citizens United applies to Montana. So that's where they're coming from. So we think that it's only an amendment that will really do it so that it becomes part of our Constitution and part of the fabric of our democracy. I don't think that an amendment, while it perhaps looks like an extreme lift from here, really is. I think part of the issue is that everyone speaks about it as though it's impossible, because that allows these kinds of undemocratic postures to remain entrenched and in place. When people do choose to amend the Constitution, it can happen very quickly, as it did when 18-year-olds were given the vote. If the American people see that something is correct, they will do it. And I think throughout our history, you'll notice that amendments tend to come in clusters. And we think that that's because, for example, in the Progressive Era, once you pass an amendment, that burden of impossibility is lifted. And folks say, ah, that actually wasn't too hard, was it? All right, now let's address this issue. And so that's the kind of thing we're hoping to have happen here, because Americans overwhelmingly believe that our government is corrupted by money and that something needs to be done about it. So we hope to provide some hope and a path to spur action.
Michelle Sutter, where I live in Connecticut and in many eastern states, voters can't pass binding referenda. But in California, you've passed all kinds of binding referendum questions. Why did Movi, Money Out, Voters In, choose to pursue a non-binding referendum in this case?
We're not enacting any sort of California law, right? What our bill will do, or now Proposition 49, is call upon the Congress to act. So we're not changing anything in California. So the way that Californians have historically used their voter advisory mechanism, and we use it very, very sparingly, is when national policy is directly at odds with the will of the California people. So we are commenting on a national situation and letting the United States Congress know that we want them to get busy about this and make this a priority.
So far, 16 states have passed a call for a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United.
That's 16 states' legislatures. But the movement is much bigger than that. There actually are only 8 states in the United States who have taken no action on this matter, the Overturned Citizens United call. It is in process in 20 other state legislatures. It's been introduced. And there are a number of states where there have only been municipal actions. For example, Utah, Salt Lake City, passed a resolution calling on the Congress to get us an amendment about this. And this is one of those things where you go, wait a minute, this is going on in 42 states, and I don't see this anywhere in the media. What is that about? And we think that's about how handsomely media profit from all of the money that is spent on campaigns.
You said there are two routes to a constitutional amendment. Can you elaborate?
There are two ways to amend the Constitution. One is it begins in Congress and goes to the states. And if that doesn't happen, the other option is the states call for a convention and convene with delegates, with representatives, and they actually wind up writing the amendment and taking it back to the states and just leaving Congress out of the process. So California has acted both ways. California and Vermont are the two states so far, and we hope that that catches fire as well, because we think this is an issue that does require the kitchen sink and whatever else we can throw at it.
That was Michelle Sutter of the group Money Out Voters In and chairperson of the Yes on Prop 49 campaign. For more news and analysis on efforts to overturn recent Supreme Court rulings on money and politics, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.